It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama says chances for Ebola outbreak in U.S. extremely low. Kurds and Islamic State battle for Syrian border town. I'm Ray Kugel reporting from Washington. A Spanish nurse who helped treat an Ebola patient in a Madrid hospital has contracted the virus, becoming the first person to become infected outside West Africa. Spanish health officials say the nurse was part of the medical team that treated a 69-year-old Spanish priest who died in a hospital last month after being flown back from Sierra Leone. An American photojournalist diagnosed in Liberia with the Ebola virus returned to the United States for treatment. He is in an isolation unit at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, where a spokesman says his condition is being evaluated. President Obama says the chances for an Ebola outbreak here in the United States are extremely low.
We don't have a lot of margin for error. The procedures and protocols that are put in place must be followed. One of the things that we discussed today was how we can make sure that we're spreading the word across hospitals, clinics, any place where a patient might first come in contact with a medical worker to make sure that they know what to look out for, and they're putting in place the protocols and following those protocols strictly.
President Obama says some countries are not doing enough to confront the Ebola crisis in West Africa. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta says he'll transfer power to his deputy while he attends a hearing on his case Wednesday at The Hague's International Criminal Court. Mr. Kenyatta faces 5 charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly helping to organize post-election violence and rock Kenya in 2008. The Kenyan leader says while he is out of the country, his deputy William Ruto will serve as the acting president. This is VOA News. Kurdish fighters and Islamic State militants are engaged in fierce street battles for control of the northern Syrian border town of Kobani. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least 27 militants and 19 Kurds have been killed over the past 2 days. The fighting has sent thousands of civilians fleeing for their lives across the border into Turkey. A 19-year-old American was arrested for allegedly attempting to travel overseas to join the militant group Islamic State. The U.S. Department of Justice says Mohammed Hamza Khan was taken into custody without incident last Saturday at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport by the FBI before he attempted to fly on to Istanbul. Khan was charged in U.S. District Court with 1 count of attempting to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization operating inside Iraq and Syria. If convicted, he faces a maximum penalty of 15 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. North and South Korean warship exchange warning shots near a disputed sea border today. Seoul defense officials say a South Korean naval ship fired a warning shot after a North Korean vessel crossed the so-called northern limit line off the western coast. The North Korean ship returned fire before retreating. No injuries or damage are reported. Hong Kong student activists leading a week-long occupation of city streets are set to have more talks today with a government official to discuss how to start a dialogue on democratic reform. Hong Kong political scientist Sunny Low thinks he's skeptical about the outcome of the dialogue.
The protesters and the government negotiators may fail to come up with a satisfactory solution on political reform, and eventually the police crackdown on the protest movement will be inevitable, resulting in possible arrest and even more resistance from some of the protesters.
The activists are demanding the reversal of a Chinese government ruling that Hong Kong can only elect its leader under universal suffrage in 2017 if candidates are vetted by a pro-Beijing committee. Hong Kong officials have said they must abide by that ruling. Mexico's president said there will be no impunity for those responsible for the recent disappearance of 43 students in the country's south. Enrique Peña Nieto made the pledge Monday, calling the disappearances outrageous and unacceptable. Authorities in the southern state of Guerrero found a mass grave Saturday and said the site could contain the bodies of the missing students. But Mexican investigators are awaiting further DNA confirmation. And the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for more U.S. states to allow same-sex marriage by refusing to hear several appeals on the issue. The top U.S. court decided not to consider the appeals against recent rulings by lower courts.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United States considers additional Ebola screening measures at airports.
Yeah, we're also going to be working on protocols to do additional passenger screening, both at the source and here in the United States. All of these things make me confident that here in the United States, at least, the rate of an epidemic here are extraordinarily low.
That's U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Monday at the White House. Zimbabwe doctors call off their strike action to make way for negotiations. African peacekeepers say Somalia's Al-Shabaab has reached a point of no return following the capture of a key town. And Liberia's justice minister has resigned.
For me, I need full cooperation and support. I need resources to do my work, and I need support, moral support to do my work.
Christian Attah is Liberia's justice minister who resigned yesterday. Kenya's president says he will appear this week at the International Criminal Court. And Kenya's school feeding program powers bodies and minds. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Barack Obama says the United States is considering additional measures to screen passengers for Ebola. The measures will be taken at airports, both in West Africa and at U.S. points of entry. As VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports, President Obama's remarks came as a Liberian man, Thomas Eric Duncan, who is the first person to be diagnosed with Ebola in the United States, is listed in critical condition at a Dallas hospital.
As authorities in the southwestern state of Texas deal with the only known Ebola case on U.S. soil, President Obama called a meeting Monday with cabinet members and other top officials of the team he has set up to stop the outbreak. The U.S. leader said that in addition to launching a campaign to educate American health workers on how to deal with the disease, the team is looking at new measures to screen passengers traveling from West Africa to the United States.
Yeah, we're also going to be working on protocols to do additional passenger screening, both at the source and here in the United States.
U.S. officials are not considering a travel ban. They say imposing one would hinder the delivery of medical supplies and equipment to stricken regions of West Africa because it is commercial carriers that transport most of the shipments. Despite the one case in Texas, Mr. Obama said the chance of an outbreak in the United States is extremely low. But he indicated it is in the best interest of Americans to stop the disease at its source in West Africa.
As we speak, there are children on the streets dying of this disease, thousands of them. And so obviously my first job is to make sure that we're taking care of the American people. But we have a larger role in that.
President Obama said progress is being made against Ebola, but he said many larger nations that could do more are not doing enough. He said he plans to step up his calls for members of the international community to boost their donations and personnel. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Liberia's Justice Minister Christian Attah has resigned. In a letter of resignation on Monday, Attah said she could not be the Minister of Justice and not supervise the operations of the security agencies under her department. She cited the lack of independence to investigate allegations of fraud against the National Security Agency. In a brief statement issued Monday, the executive mansion said President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has received and accepted the resignation of the Minister of Justice and Attorney General. Attah said she first submitted her resignation in March this year, but President Sirleaf delayed acknowledging her resignation, and as a result, she stayed on, particularly in light of the national security crisis created by the Ebola virus outbreak.
Since March 31st, according to my press statement, March 31st, 2014, the president did not accept my resignation at that time, so I waited until the six-month suspension was over. And then in July, I wrote to her and told her that it had been lifted by the court. She asked me to return to work, which I did. But we were at the height of the Ebola crisis, and I thought that would be very insensitive to take any such decision. My personal matter would, be secondary to what was going on in the country.
But yet, Madam Attah, you say here that it has become unbearable to me to persevere in the name as the dutifully appointed Minister of Justice of the Republic of Liberia, when in reality concrete actions indicate a determination to systematically undermine and gut the portfolio of relevance and effectiveness. What do you mean? They do not have power.
I think I put some examples there. I think one of the examples I gave, there was some allegation of fraud against the NSA and the ministry under the National Security Reform and Intelligence Act should investigate that. And it was taken away from us and given to an independent committee because they didn't feel that we would be impartial in that matter. So I was very clear and very blunt about that. But I think generally it speaks to the fact that during the 6 months that I was away, the organization and the management of the ministry took different turns. And it will require a lot of reorganization and coordination to try to get it back to where it was in terms of command and control, reporting, and all of that.
You say, Madam Ta, that cognizant of the president's rhetoric of commitment to the rule of law, are you suggesting that the president was not committed? Because every time you talk to Liberian government officials, they mention there's rule of law in the country. It seems to me you're not pleased or you're not on board with that kind of statement.
No, I think the Ministry of Justice under my leadership and with the team that we've had and under this administration has done very well in the area of rule of law. I still think we can do better, and we do strive to do better. But I think nothing is wrong with looking at how you can continue to do better and how you can continue to strengthen in some areas. For me, I need full cooperation and support. I need resources to do my work, and I need support, moral support to do my work. If I have cooperation and I have support, and the team that I work with have cooperation and support, we tend to do very well. And that we have seen in the past.
So let me ask you, Madam Ta, there was a report carried the other day when I interviewed the police director. Was your ministry investigating the vice president of Liberia for some allegation that he might have some connection with...
The answer is simply no. The Ministry of Justice was not investigating the vice president.
Do you know if the police were investigating the vice president?
I don't know what you mean about police investigating the vice president. I know he visited the vice president. They had a conversation and that was all. But I don't know anything more than that. You have to talk to the director of police.
I want you to look back on the fight against corruption during your administration. Is there a sincerity within the Liberian government to fight corruption?
I think there was the will, and I think the Ministry of Justice under this administration did a lot to fight corruption. I think one of the things the public really doesn't realize is that the Ministry of Justice has a broad mandate. They're not only involved in corruption cases. It's a very, very huge ministry with a lot of different departments and a lot of different functions to be performed. We have huge capacity problem. We have less than 100 lawyers across the country. So it takes a lot to do. You need resources and you need well-trained lawyers. So a lot of things go on. Corruption continues to be a major area of concern for the public and for the government.
That was Liberia's Justice Minister Christiana Ta, who resigned her post yesterday, Monday. She was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Medical doctors in Zimbabwe who downed tools on last Thursday have called off their industrial action to make way for dialogue with authorities. The strike had threatened to paralyze the health delivery system at a time when the world is on high alert following the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa that has claimed more than 3,000 lives. The doctors went on strike demanding better working conditions and the reinstatement of their housing allowances that had been withdrawn by the cash-strapped Zimbabwe government.
For now, I can confirm that people sat down and resolved to get back to work from the interest of the patients while negotiations are ongoing.
Who exactly are you negotiating with?
The interested stakeholders, the ones that are being engaged, every stakeholder that has anything to do with the hearing of our demand or need, per se.
Have you tried to seek audience with the minister himself?
Yeah, of course. Of course, we have already got a response from him, which I must say is a welcome response for now.
So what is the way forward should the government fail to meet your demands?
That would have to come from all the members. Really commenting on what the way forward would be, like, would be really something that that would be offhand and maybe representing my own interest. But in the interest of the whole association and our members, I would say we'll probably come up with something, but we don't hope to get to an impasse. There seems to be solutions that are available.
Is there a time frame for these talks?
Yeah, definitely. I think within the next 10 to 14 days, we should have solved this as has been agreed. Without that, maybe people will have to sit down and maybe come up with some other idea of how to get round about.
That was reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Health Minister David Perignatua was unreachable for a comment. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 7th, and please send your comments and viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The commander of the African Union forces that dislodged the militant group Al-Shabaab from its main headquarters of Barewa says the militant group has reached a point of no return following a series of losses.
As you know, one of the mandates of AMISOM is to pacify Somalia and give peace to the people of Somalia and also to mentor the government of Somalia to ensure the Somali National Army comes to stand and defend Somalia by themselves. So the AMISOM planned a long, long term to ensure all these other areas that were infested by the Al-Shabaab are taken over by AMISOM. Now, Barawe, as any other places in Somalia, was also a target for AMISOM. So after capturing other areas like Koriole, Kutunwarei, Bulamareel, Gandeshe, and all these other areas, Barawe today became the last stronghold of Al-Shabaab. Indeed, Barawe was an economic center for Al-Shabaab where they did their business. Barawe was the tactical command headquarters for Al-Shabaab where they controlled all the operations. And indeed today, we fought them, took over the city, and it's a very pleasant victory for the AMISOM in Somalia.
So what did you find in the city? Did you find any blots that are being made by Al-Shabaab? Did you find any weapons storage, bunkers?
Yes, as we were advancing to Barawe the day before yesterday, we got the first resistance in a place called Ambresa. Ambresa is only 6 kilometers to Barawe. It is the junction that goes to Jilib, another junction that goes to Sablale, and the junction to Barawe. We met the first resistance there. We hit them hard. They hit us. We lost some soldiers, especially the SNA, and the AMISOM got some injured soldiers. Now, what happened is that they knew that was the only place they would defend Barawe from. So they fought very, very hard from 2 o'clock up to 7 o'clock in the evening. Once we beat them down there, they knew Barawe was gone, so they had to release all the prisoners that were in the cell. They had to use all the boats that were around, and they escaped out of Barawe. So this morning, as we entered Barawe, we found Barawe with a very, very small resistance. They tried to fight, but they knew we were superior. So they left all their positions with all their weapons and hid some of the weapons, which we are still looking for, and they fled into the boats towards Jilib. So we know that Al-Shabaab may come up with other tactics of counterinsurgency by the use of IEDs or sniping, but we are ready for that. But as far as I'm concerned, the Al-Shabaab disappeared and they provided a very minimum resistance this morning.
That was Brigadier General Dick Olom, commander of the African Union forces in Somalia. He was speaking with Harun Maruf of VOA Somali Service. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta says he will obey a summons to report tomorrow, Wednesday, to the International Criminal Court at The Hague, making him the first sitting head of state to appear before the court. Mr. Kenyatta and his deputy, William Ruto, are charged with crimes against humanity for allegedly orchestrating the 2007 post-election violence that killed an estimated 1,000 people. Hillary Hewler reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Last week's summons to The Hague came as a surprise to many Kenyans, more accustomed now to news the prosecution's case against their president is weak and on the verge of collapse. Mr. Kenyatta had asked to be excused from the status conference Wednesday or to be allowed to appear via video link, but his request was turned down. The court said the case was at a critical juncture and his presence is required. President Kenyatta told the Kenyan parliament Monday he would obey the summons.
I urge my fellow citizens to accept and to understand my decision. I also urge our African brothers and sisters to stand with Kenya and all people of goodwill and friends of Kenya to stand with us in this time.
The president said his deputy, William Ruto, will serve as acting president while he's out of the country. Last year, the African Union resolved that sitting African heads of state should not appear before the ICC, a decision that came after relentless lobbying by Mr. Kenyatta. So the Kenyan president was faced with a dilemma, says University of Nairobi political scientist Adams Olo.
The dilemma for the president is how to balance two things. One, his case in the court versus the African Union resolution. And therefore, what he shall be asking himself is, if I don't attend legally, what's going to happen to me?
What would happen is the ICC would issue an arrest warrant, says the head of the East Africa Law Society, James Mwamu. This could have devastating consequences for Mr. Kenyatta and for Kenya, he says, including possible sanctions from the West.
President Kenyatta will be a fugitive and a pariah, running away from the law. If you see the situation with the president of Sudan, he can't travel. And then cooperation with international agencies and donors is going to be a bit difficult.
But many in Mr. Kenyatta's Jubilee Alliance have thrown themselves behind the AU resolution, saying a court appearance would embarrass the president. Before the ICC, Olo explains, Mr. Kenyatta will appear as an ordinary citizen, which could affect his public image.
Politics is about perception, and therefore the concern of Jubilee is that for that small few moments, the president is not going to have the trappings of power that we have come to know him with.
But in the past, he adds, Mr. Kenyatta and Ruto have been skillful in using the case to mobilize their base.
How they were able to really get their two communities behind them was to play victim, that the West have a preferred candidate, the one to recolonize the country. It's worked so well.
Given the weakness of the prosecution's case, the president's cooperation could actually boost his image back home, says Olo. This is what many Kenyatta supporters have been arguing.
Quite a number of them are like, go there, prove to the world that you always said you would cooperate, and you are cooperating. You'll walk out of there very tall and say, let them have their way. I have had my say.
In the meantime, local media reports dozens of Kenyan lawmakers plan to accompany Mr. Kenyatta to The Hague in a show of support. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Kibera, a large and poor informal settlement in Nairobi, Kenya, one school is doing more than feeding students' minds. As Lenny Ruvaga reports, it is also feeding their stomachs.
32-year-old Mildred Ouma goes about her daily routine. Every morning at 6 o'clock, she wakes up her son, Augustine, and prepares him for school. The 4-year-old has a glass of milk and a bite of unleavened bread called chapati before he heads off to school. He is one of only a few students who get anything to eat before going to class. This school, called Seed School Kibera, began offering early childhood education 7 years ago to underprivileged children. Today, there are 60 students ranging from 3 to 14 years of age. Benjamin Odhiambo, who has been teaching at the school for the last 2 years, says it caters to both the minds and bodies of its students.
The children look forward to the meals because most of these children come from less privileged families. This is the only meal they can afford within a day. So we are not just feeding them physically, but we are also nourishing them intellectually.
Unemployment here is rife, and most students come to school hungry, which can lead to a lack of concentration and poor performance. So the school started a food program. At 10 a.m., the students have porridge, and at 1 p.m., they get served a hot, nutritious lunch before they leave for home 3 hours later. Mildred Ouma is among the lucky few who own a business that can provide for her family's basic needs. She makes around $10 a day from selling groundnuts and buns. But she is grateful for the meals her son gets at school.
The school is close to my business, and the fact that they give me meals is great. But Augustine may not be able to stay there when he graduates from class 3. If it happens, I will ask them to help them find a place in a similar school.
Patrick Aoki, the school's director, says the food program is financed by employing some of the parents to make beaded jewelry. Sales of the necklaces and bangles generate about $120 a month.
We have an economical challenge in the slums. So one major thing we actually do is to offer a feeding program for the children. This supports them actually to be able to grow intellectually and maybe physically to be able to concentrate in their learning.
For Augustine and his schoolmates, this education may provide a way out of poverty into a more promising future. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenyans Dennis Kipruto Kimeto and Jairus Kipchoge Birech, along with Botswana's Nigel Amos, are among 10 nominees for the 2014 World Male Athlete of the Year Award, the World Athletics Governing Body IAAF revealed in Monaco. Kimeto recently stole the limelight when he improved the world marathon record by 26 seconds to 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds at the Berlin Marathon in Germany. Birech has been in dominant form in the 3,000-meter steeplechase during the IAAF Diamond League. He also won the event at the IAAF Continental Cup in Marrakech, Morocco. Birech is the only athlete this year to run the 3,000-meter steeplechase in under 8 minutes. Botswana's Amos is the World Diamond League 800-meter winner. He also clinched the gold medal at the British Commonwealth Games, the African Championships and IAAF Continental Cup. Staying in Monaco, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba is the only African among the 10 nominees for the 2014 World Female Athlete of the Year Award. Dibaba was in scintillating form during the indoor season, where she set 2 world indoor records, won gold medals at the World Indoor Championships and IAAF Continental Cup. Voting for the top 3 nominees in the men's and women's categories is open to the public and closes on the 16th of October, the IAAF disclosed. In football, Rwanda has intensified its crackdown on 60 top football players to determine if they change their identity in order to secure Rwanda citizenship. Rwanda Football Federation Secretary General Olivier Mulinda Habi told the Kigali media on Monday that any player who may have changed their names must revert back to their original identity and nationality before they can reapply for Rwanda citizenship through the proper channels. Mulinda Habi says they are working closely with the police and immigration authorities on the matter. This investigation comes in the wake of Rwanda's disqualification from the ongoing 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers in August for fielding Dadi Birori, who had a Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo passports bearing different names and dates of birth. Finally, hosts Namibia beat Algeria 3-1 in Windhoek as Zambia and visitors Cameroon drew 0-0 in Lusaka in women's friendly matches over the weekend. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A Spanish nurse who helped treat an Ebola patient at a Madrid hospital has contracted the virus, becoming the first person to become infected outside West Africa. Spanish health officials Monday said the nurse was part of the medical team that treated a 69-year-old Spanish priest who died in a hospital last month after being flown back from Sierra Leone. Despite the news from Spain and the hospitalization of a fifth American to contract the disease, U.S. President Barack Obama Monday said the chances for an Ebola outbreak in the United States are extremely low. Mr. Obama said his administration is working on additional protocols for screening airplane passengers to identify people who might have the deadly virus. That's it for this Tuesday, October 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the dry lands of Africa, where poverty and the environment intersect. 60% of sub-Saharan Africa is classified as arid, semi-arid, or sub-humid. Poor soil and drought in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel are annual concerns. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter.